Well, thank you very much for that introduction. I'd actually like to begin with an apology. Some of you may know my boss, Malcolm Eady, the assistant governor of the Financial System Group at the bank, originally planned to be here today. However, there was a meeting of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision yesterday in Seoul, called at short notice. And flight schedules being what they are, John Laker managed to make it back, but Malcolm's still in a plane, so I'm here in his place. Now, this switch of personnel is just one example of a particular consequence of the crisis. That is that there's an enormous work program of regulatory reform in progress internationally, and there are some very tight deadlines on that. And that means that many of us in the regulatory community are attending a lot more international meetings than we used to. I'm not going to discuss the substance of those regulatory reforms today or their implications for Australia. I understand John's going to do that. Instead, I want to restrict my reflections to two specific lessons from the crisis. The first lesson is how important it is that the central bank and prudential supervisor cooperate closely. The second is that financial stability analysis requires new approaches, better analytical tools, and more data than were available in many countries prior to the crisis. On the first of these lessons, supervisors and central banks need to cooperate because we bring different things to the authority's response to financial distress. The supervisor has access to information about individual firms that goes beyond the formal data collections. The central bank's role in financial markets allows it to monitor events in real time. The two institutions have different sensibilities, and we look at data in different ways. And it's useful to have those different perspectives. I should note that effective cooperation does not require that the key officials in the supervisory authority be former central bankers. Now, some of the people I talk regularly to at APRA were never at the RBA. And others were, but I didn't know them then. I was far too junior. What matters is that we hold true to the idea that it is our professional duty to cooperate. Now, a number of commentators claim that the lessons of the crisis have implications for the institutional organisation of financial regulation. In particular, some assert that it shows that the bank supervisor should be inside the central bank, whereas others assert that the same experience shows that it should not be. I'm not compelled by either side of that argument. Some countries with bank supervision inside the central bank were heavily affected by the crisis, while others were not. Likewise, some countries with one or more specialist prudential regulators outside the central bank were among those most affected by the crisis. Others, including Australia and Canada, were much less affected. I do think that there are important synergies between banking and insurance supervision, so it makes sense to put these two things together. But where the supervising entity sits matters far less than whether it has the powers, the resources, and, in my view, most importantly, the organisational culture to do its job effectively and independently. Now, regardless of whether the supervisor is inside or outside of the central bank, it's important that it shares the information with the team in the central bank that's responsible for monitoring the stability of the financial system. When I'm at an international meeting, I sometimes hear my counterparts complain that they can't get all the data they need from the supervisor, even if the supervisor is another division of the central bank. I'm glad to say that in Australia we don't have that problem. There's an established cost-sharing arrangement. If we want the data, we just have to ask. We can have it. We do have to give John a bit more money, but we can have it. Now, today is World Statistics Day. I don't know if you knew that. So it seems particularly apposite to be making this point today. It's a serious point. I would like to emphasise just how important this statistical function is. Timely, high-quality data are essential if we're to have any hope of identifying risks and vulnerabilities in the financial system. The bank also uses the data collected by APRA in the course of its monetary policy function. For example, the money and credit aggregates that are published by the bank at the end of every month, as well as the loan approvals data published by the Bureau of Statistics, are all compiled from raw data that are collected by APRA. Reserve Bank staff work closely with the statistics team at APRA to maintain the quality of the data provided by the banks and the other financial institutions. We put a high priority on this function. But of course, the raw data are provided by the financial institutions, and they also need to devote enough resources to ensure that they are reporting timely, accurate, and meaningful data to APRA. This point brings me to the second lesson from the crisis that I'd like to speak about today. And that is that financial stability analysts don't just need accurate data. We need more data. We need new analytical tools. And in some cases, we need to take a broader approach to that analysis. Now, I'm not suggesting that there's anything inherently wrong with the economics profession's basic approach to financial stability analysis before the crisis. I'm not suggesting that the Financial Stability Department at the RBA was doing anything wrong. Many of the underlying risks had actually been identified, though perhaps not in the ways they were connected. But the events of the crisis taught us that some aspects of the financial system had not been given enough attention. For example, wholesale markets could become less liquid and reliable than some people had previously assumed. Another example is that the so-called shadow banking system was more important than some observers had appreciated, especially in the United States, though less so in Australia. A third is that it is not just big firms or direct exposures to a firm that can cause contagion. Crowded trades also matter when they're all herding into one thing. If many firms have similar positions, they can all be affected if one of them should become distressed. Now, related to this point, the events of the crisis emphasised that financial stability analysis is not the same as most of the macroeconomic analysis done in advance of monetary policy decisions. In particular, for financial stability analysis, it is not enough to just look at the aggregate data or average data. We need to track the tails of the distribution, where the worst risks are. So where my colleagues in economic group are mainly focused on what's likely to happen, the team and I in Financial Stability Department tend to focus on the less likely things that might go wrong. So we often find ourselves looking at the same data, but in different ways and from different perspectives. For an example of the case where aggregate data might be misleading, in fact can be outright misleading, I'd like you to consider this graph. It shows how much the ratio of housing prices and household debt to household income increased, expressed in percentage points of household income, over the boom period of 2000 to 2006. And it was comparisons like this that drew some observers to conclude that the United States was less likely to have had a housing bubble than some of the other countries shown on the graph. Now, of course, that doesn't ring true considering how things turned out. Understanding why requires looking at much more disaggregated data. These would have shown that lending standards had eased much further in the US mortgage market than in those other countries. More US households were taking out loans with very small deposits or for larger amounts than they could reasonably pay back, and it turns out that the banks, in some cases, didn't actually know who it was that actually owned the loan, as we're finding out in the media nowadays. But because most borrowers were still taking out conventional or prime loans, as they're known in the US mortgage market, none of this was obvious from the kind of aggregated data that is shown in this graph. I'd like to show you an example of both disaggregated data and some of the kind of new data that we find useful in financial stability. This graph shows a slightly more detailed version of some APRA data that we've already presented in the last few financial stability reviews. What they show is the flow of newly originated owner-occupier housing loans, so as they're written, disaggregated by the loan-to-valuation ratio at origination. These data are quite new. They're only available since the start of 2008, though planning for the collection started several years before that. Now, these data provide an insight into loan-to-valuation ratios on new loans. In particular, they help us understand whether the increase in the average loan-to-valuation ratio on new loans has occurred because there are more high-ratio loans or just fewer low-ratio loans. And it's not hard to see that the implications for risk in the household sector would be very different depending on which of those was true. Well, that brings us back to the regulatory reform process. Alongside the goal of improving banks' resilience through stronger capital and liquidity positions, there's the goal of improving the resilience of the system as a whole. It means detecting the build-up of risk-taking and leverage as it happens. And it means seeing the concentrations of risk, not just what's happening on average. All of these concerns imply that financial institutions will be expected to report and disclose more information than in the past. It will be up to central banks and other regulators to make good use of it. Thank you.
Lucy Ellis, can I ask you, do you have concerns from a stability point of view that one of the consequences of this wall of changes in regulation internationally has seen a clearer distinction between utility banking and other forms of banking? So we see Goldman Sachs spinning off its prop trading desk. We see hedge funds relocating to Switzerland. We see large amounts of the sort of, you know, robustly traded Aussie dollar being held by, you know, international hedge funds. Is there a sense in that we've pushed a lot of the risk to our financial system into the non-bank sector, out of the prudential space, and into a shadow zone that we may not be able to monitor in the sort of real-time way that we can when they're in the other sector from a stability point of view?
Thanks, Martin. It's an important question. Certainly, it wouldn't be a good outcome for financial stability if you make the banking sector extremely safe by pushing all the risk somewhere else. And in fact, if you think about the GFC, a lot of the problem there was that people thought they were making things safer by spreading the risk somewhere else. In fact, they weren't even spreading it, but it didn't make the system safer. I think this is a question that people are very alive to. People are aware that that would not be a good outcome, and there's a lot of sort of hard thinking about sort of the perimeter of regulation, and that's something that's been
We've seen an effective arbitrage going on where people have moved prop desk to hedge funds, they've moved from London to Geneva, they've moved to Singapore, they've moved all of this, and it's ironic in the week that Benoît Mandelbrot, now that we're celebrating statisticians, passed away, it's ironic that into this jurisdiction has come KKR looking to pick up a wealth management fund, in a sector where you have to start to wonder about the is all of this regulation not just creating another long fat tail risk out there in the future? That you can't see?
Well, I think that's actually where I was getting to data. We're not just talking about regulated financial institutions providing data. I mean, I think surveillance of the whole financial system. We actually put a box in the last financial stability review on this, on the shadow banking system. At present, what you would call the shadow banking system in Australia is a much smaller fraction of the overall system of overall assets in the financial system than it is, for example, in the US. These are issues that we're live to, and that's basically our job to maintain clear oversight of the financial stability of the system as a whole. And I think people are aware that if you clamp down the rules on one side so much, the risk will move. I have to say that given the minds of the minds and the motivation of the Swiss and Singaporean regulators, I'm not sure that switching domiciles for hedge funds is actually really going to help them that much compared to moving from London. I think, again, this gets down to the organisational culture of regulators that I mentioned earlier, and you can't graph that. You can't sort of tick a box and say, yes, they've got the right organisational culture. Culture is very hard to measure, but my assessment would be that at the moment we have some very motivated regulators, and it's not clear that switching domiciles is necessarily going to give them much arbitrage.